Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Sarah Clark, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Tonight, we're excited to host this Courthouse Steps Oral Argument Program on Gillette versus New Jersey Transit Corporation, which was argued before the court on Wednesday. We're very pleased to welcome our moderator, Philip Williamson, who is a partner of Tatsitinius and Hollister LLP. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we'll turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I will note, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Mr. Williamson, thank you so much for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
As Sarah said, on Wednesday, the Supreme Court heard arguments in Gillette versus New Jersey Transit Corporation, along with a consolidated case, Colt versus New Jersey Transit Corporation, which are two cases about the boundaries of interstate sovereign immunity. So the New Jersey Transit Corporation operates the public transit system for the state of New Jersey, as the name suggests, with some extensions into Pennsylvania and New York, which turn out to be pretty important for the case we heard on Wednesday. Now, the New Jersey Transit Corporation was established as, quote, a body corporate and politic within the executive branch of New Jersey. The board is largely appointed by the New Jersey governor with a few interesting hitches, and its actions are subject to the governor's veto. It has rulemaking authority subject to the New Jersey Administrative Procedures Act. It can sue and be sued, seemingly separately from the state. And New Jersey has limited the Transit Corporation's authority to plead sovereign immunity in certain categories of suits. This gave rise to the question, is the New Jersey Transit Corporation an arm of the state of New Jersey for purposes of interstate sovereign immunity? Remember what I said about operating extensions in Pennsylvania and New York. Two plaintiffs were hit by New Jersey Transit Corporation buses, one in Pennsylvania and one in New York City. They sued the Transit Corporation, and the Pennsylvania Supreme Court and the New York Court of Appeals came up with different answers to that arm of New Jersey question. New York said that the Transit Corporation was not an arm of New Jersey. It looked to the state's definition of the entity, the state's power to direct the entity, and the effect on the state of a judgment against the Transit Corporation. And after basically concluding the factors were awash, decided that the impact on the state of New Jersey was the most important factor, figured New Jersey's not going to have to pay the judgment. We're not doing offense to our sister state. And so the Transit Corporation is not an arm of New Jersey for interstate sovereign immunity purposes. Pennsylvania came out the opposite way, giving primacy to New Jersey, defining the Transit Corporation as an arm of the state. In briefing in front of the Supreme Court, both sides seem to agree, or at least operate from the premise, that there is some kind of multi-factor test involved. And the major question seems to be, how do you read the factors and what governs? Which brings me to our panelists, who I think both in different ways offered maybe a more straightforward, more bright line path. I'll start with Professor Will Bode, who is the Harry Calvin Professor of Law and Faculty Director of the Constitutional Law Institute at the University of Chicago Law School. And together with Professor Stephen Sachs, he filed a brief supporting the plaintiffs, taking the position that states enjoy interstate sovereign immunity, but that separate legal persons from the state do not enjoy that same immunity. And that interstate sovereign immunity is a state common law doctrine, not a constitutional one, which is why the sort of the separate legal personhood makes a great difference. On the other side, you have Ryan Walters, who's the Deputy Attorney General for Legal Strategy in the Texas Attorney General's Office, and perhaps most importantly, a graduate of the Ohio State University. Texas led a 23-state brief in support of the Transit Corporation, arguing for a similar bright-line rule. Factors and balancing tests are difficult to manage and often unpredictable, and so instead, state law should control. If the state says this entity is an arm of the state, this entity is an arm of the state. At the very least, if you don't like that bright line, it should create a presumption of immunity that's rebutted only by finding that the entity itself performs functions that are not really connected to the state's police power. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to the professors. Tell me what I missed on the table setting.
Thanks very much for tuning in and for setting up this case. What does the original meaning of the Constitution say about somebody who gets hit by a bus? Who says originalism doesn't have real world consequences? I think it's right that the case is very much framed in a sense as how do we think about the nature of sovereign immunity and how do we think about the nature of the state of New Jersey? And the position that Sachs and I took, which we think is the sort of historically grounded position, is that immunity is for sovereigns. And so the question is the New Jersey Bus Transit Corporation a sovereign? And we think the answer is no, it's not a sovereign. It's a separate corporation. And at the founding, that would have been a sort of pretty much a cut and dried question. If you create a corporation and give it the power to sue and be sued, the purpose of doing that is to create something that doesn't have the state's immunity from suit. Now, the modern doctrine has confused that somewhat. The court asked a lot of probing questions about that. You know, is it just being labeled a corporation or is there a little more to it? And I think we found the justice really asking kind of the right kinds of questions. A couple of fault lines I think we saw come up at oral argument that'd be worth talking about and thinking through would be, one is, how do we even ask this question? Is the question de facto or de jure? So the question, if you look on paper, if you look at the statutes of New Jersey and the case law of the New Jersey Supreme Court describing the New Jersey Transit Corporation, it seems quite clear that it is separate from the state of New Jersey in a range of legal ways. It's its own legal person. It has the power to sue and be sued in its own name. When it loses a case, the state is not automatically bound by the judgments against it. If it owes money, if it has debts, the state doesn't legally have to pay them, and so on. One of the things the state tried to stress in argument is that while that's true on paper, that's not really true. You know, they said, look, we've always been there to cover the New Jersey Transit Corporation's liabilities. In reality, they said a judgment against New Jersey Transit Corporation will be a judgment against the state. Like we pay for it. And so you saw a lot of questions about sort of which way to think about it. Is the question sort of the de facto control and sort of traceability, or is the question de jure? I tend to think the right way to think about it is de jure rather than de facto. You know, if you think about a bank, a major bank in the United States that's too big to fail and that we all know would be bailed out by the federal government if it came to that, or, you know, Fannie Mae or whatnot, the fact that the federal government would be there to bail it out doesn't mean that it's an arm of the United States necessarily. But we have a more formal inquiry for that. We might say, look, it's still a private corporation, even though the United States would bail it out. And even if the United States owns a lot of its stock, for instance, and could control what it does. But that's one of the things the court's going to have to grapple with, and one of the things you're going to see them kind of talk about. A second sort of related question we saw them ask about, I think Justice Kavanaugh put it this way, is what is the blast radius of the petitioner's position? How much kind of damage will be done, or how much will blow up if the court says, look, corporations are not sovereigns, immunity is for sovereigns. A lot of the attention in particular seems to be focused on the state of Louisiana, which for reasons that nobody outside of Louisiana understands has denominated many parts of its government as separate corporations. So the Louisiana Justice Department is a corporation and the Louisiana Corrections Department is a corporation. I think this is where those questions about sort of separate legal personhood might really be helpful. I don't think it's the case that the Louisiana Justice Department sues in its own name without binding the state of Louisiana. I don't think it has its own assets that are independent of the state and so on. I think that sort of nature of its corporate structure has to do with Louisiana's distinct legal history and legal heritage. But those are the kinds of questions the court's grappling with as well. You might imagine that whatever they say, they might just have a footnote saying, we don't really know about Louisiana. That'll be a separate case, which Louisiana, I'm sure, would appreciate. And then I think a third question that might be another way to frame this before we hear from Mr. Walters' other way of thinking about it would be, to what extent do states have to take the bitter with the sweet? So the kind of classical corporate law approach that Professor Saxon described and that you saw the petitioners arguing is, given that New Jersey has set this corporation up to be separate in so many ways, has intentionally created as a corporation its own legal personhood, has given it the ability to have its own assets, in part because it wants people to be able to engage in commercial transactions without implicating the state, in part because state constitutional law requires it to do so in various ways. Various state budgetary requirements and state constitutional requirements require them to structure the corporation this way. That choice, we would say, has consequences. The choice to sort of set up a separate person is the choice to set up something that's not the sovereign, because sovereignty is a property of the person of the sovereign. I think, you know, you could imagine saying otherwise. You could imagine saying, no, the state is allowed to have its cake and eat it too, or to have the sweet without the bitter, and to set up something that's independent when the state wants it to be, but still the state when they don't want it to be. And I think whether they can do that or whether sovereign immunity kind of allows that kind of bespoke, you know, sovereign for some purposes and not others, might be one of the big questions and ways to think about the case.
Mr. Walters, what do you think? What did you see in argument?
I thought the argument was very interesting. To a large extent, I think the attorneys were focused on what had already been briefed, but there were a few surprises. I will say, as an initial matter, what you said is that, you know, I think one thing that Professors Bode and Sachs and the multi-state coalition that Texas led sort of agree on is that a more bright line rule instead of a burger court era multi-factor balancing test would be ideal. I think the question is what direction we go on that. You know, I think our perspective is that the states have this inherent sovereign authority to define state law and state institutions, and the intent. So they should have flexibility to structure their state institutions in a way that they desire, and that other states, at least, should be required to follow what the initial state, how it defines its own state government, its own state entities. One thing that I thought was, there were, I think, several of the justices were seemed to be very sympathetic to at least adjacent to Professor Bode and Sachs's position on a bright line rule about the corporate form. And Justice Jackson, Justice Sotomayor, I think, were very vocal on that and seemed to show their cards on that. Justice Thomas also asked some questions that would seem to indicate some sympathy to that, not surprisingly. And Justice Barrett's questions were largely about precedent and you know, indicating that she thought that nothing would have to be overturned in order to find for the plaintiffs here and against the New Jersey Transit Corporation's sovereign, you know, purported sovereign immunity here. The most interesting things I thought were Justice Kagan's discussion on the Biden versus Nebraska case, which was briefed a little bit by the parties and the amici, but I think it took a lot larger role. Played a lot larger role in the arguments than I had expected. Justice Kagan, interesting to her, her promotion of that case as being relevant to the sovereign immunity here was that she wrote the dissenting opinion in that case, which involved Mohila, which was a corporate entity set up by the state of Missouri. Missouri had been found to have Article 3 standing based on the injuries to Mohila, and the majority went through largely a similar analysis of control and purpose of Mohila as is done in the sovereign immunity context. So Justice Kagan thought that it made no sense to make a distinction between the standing inquiry, the harm to the state, and the sovereign immunity inquiry here. And it seemed like Justice Kavanaugh and maybe Justice Alito also were, you know, brought that up. Justice Thomas also had some interest in that. The I don't know that means that Justice Kagan is going to rule for New Jersey Transit in this case. She may be just, poking at the conservative leaning justices and to hold them to their own views in her eyes. The other interesting case that was mentioned, that was just very briefly mentioned in the briefing, was Judge Bork's D.C. Circuit opinion in Morris, which was one of the big factors here is that the state of New Jersey is not formally liable for any of the debts or liabilities of New Jersey Transit. And that's obviously been a big factor here. But Judge Bork, joined by Judge Scalia on the D.C. Circuit in 1986, wrote an opinion about a bi-state two states and the District of Columbia entity, the Transit Authority, and found that it had sovereign immunity, even though and mostly based on a functional sort of analysis of the two states and the District of Columbia having to fund the entity as a practical matter in order for it to survive, that it was structured in that way. And that's similar to New Jersey's argument here with New Jersey Transit. Interestingly, it seemed like Justice Kavanaugh, Roberts, and Alito were more inclined to at least indicate an openness to the functional test on that front rather than a bright line rule on the liability. But and interestingly, Judge Kavanaugh in 2008 in the Puerto Rico Ports Authority case, he relied very heavily on Judge Bork's earlier opinion in the Morris case to find that Puerto Rico had sovereign immunity and on a functional basis. So obviously, then Judge Kavanaugh and Judges Bork and Scalia on the D.C. Circuit were, even though they have originalist leanings as lower court judges, obviously they're not, with vertical stare decisis, they don't have the freedom that the Supreme Court justices have. So that doesn't mean that Justice Kavanaugh is going to find the same way here. But those, I think, were the two most interesting. And it's to be hard to predict. And there are also some side issues. Justice Gorsuch seemed to be interested in an argument advanced by one of the plaintiffs and by Professors Bode and Sachs in their brief about the 11th Amendment and whether it would preclude Supreme Court review of the state Supreme Court rulings on this front, because they involve citizens of states against another state. And the question is whether there is a subject matter jurisdiction in the federal courts to reach that. And it seemed like Justice Gorsuch, at least, was interested in that. And Justice Thomas had joined an earlier opinion by Justice Gorsuch in the, I think it's the Penn East case, so that may be another avenue that might lead to potentially to a fractured court here, if there are some justices who find that to be persuasive and not don't go into the details on the other aspects of the case.
I want to poke the Mohila piece a little bit, the way that Justice Kagan did, which is to ask, maybe I'll ask you broadly, what do we do with the standing analysis in Biden versus Nebraska? And is it really enough, as maybe New Jersey suggested, to say, well, Mohila was about standing and not about immunity? Given that standing and immunity are ultimately both questions about whether this party ought to be in this court for this case.
Yeah, I'm not surprised that Mohila was kind of front of mind for many of the justices, since that's probably the last time a lot of them thought carefully about phrases like soon be sued and state public corporation. I'm sure as they were sort of trying to think through these, state law entities that they don't grapple with on a daily basis, that's like the thing that it reminded them of. And in the briefing in Biden versus Nebraska, one of the sort of debates floating around in the briefing was, is MOHELA an arm of the state of Missouri for sovereign immunity purposes? And if so, is that relevant here? And in fact, that's a question on which the lower courts had been divided when Biden versus Tabasco went up. So one of the arguments was like, which set of courts are right about even, you know, the sovereign immunity question as to MOHELA, are judgments against MOHELA, judgments against the state or not, applying these kinds of multi-factor balancing tests. So I think that question was floating around at the time of Biden versus Nebraska. And I'm not surprised that it's kind of like floated back to the surface as people sort of thinking about this. But I do think the state's probably right that we could put it to one side for a couple of reasons. I mean, I think the court, for better or worse, has defined Article III injury in fact as a kind of broader and more capacious conception than just legal personhood. To take the sort of, again, maybe a controversial example, but an obvious example, you can be injured. Somebody who wants to go to Mineral King or Sequoia National Park can claim standing based on injuries to the park, you know, cutting down a bunch of trees that destroy the natural beauty of the park. They are not the park, right? The park is has its own legal status. Justice Douglas famously wanted to, you know, grant legal personhood to trees, which we've never done and probably shouldn't do, but that's not, you know, the person would not be the same. And similarly, you know, in some contexts, parents have the ability to sue for injuries on behalf of their children and so on without the parents being the children. We do have a kind of that representational attitude towards standing. And in fact, that was what Chief Justice Roberts said in response to Justice Kagan when she was making these points in her dissent in Biden versus Nebraska. As he said, look, a public corporation can count as part of the state for some, but not other purposes, end quote. So I think in Biden versus Nebraska, the court took the view that the Article III standing question was not tied to the arm of the state question because they didn't want to have to figure out the arm of the state question. So I do think it would be a kind of, there's some kind of inappropriate back counting if in case one, the court says, okay, this question doesn't turn on this other question because it doesn't want to get into the other question. And then in case two, they come along and say, oh, actually, we're not, you know, the other question is now controlled by the first question because they gotta think this arm of the state thing through sometime. The other thought I do think, and I strongly agree with Ryan Walters that the kind of functionalist balancing tests loomed large over the whole case. I mean, I think we all know the 1970s were not always kind to constitutional law. And in 1977, the Supreme Court had this case, Mount Healthy City School District versus Doyle, where it kind of took whatever we could debate, whatever the bright line rule used to be, or whatever the principles used to be, but it took whatever principles there used to be. It got this arm of the state case about a school district, the Mount Healthy City School District. And its attitude towards that case was resolved in one paragraph, which just said, well, the question is whether the Mount Healthy School District is more like the state or more like a city. Because cities do not have sovereign immunity, I would say, because they're municipal corporations, but for whatever reason. And then it said, well, here are some facts about the school district. So it seems more like the state than the city. And now that sort of statement of facts has turned into a multi-factor balancing test in search of this question, like what is a state and what is a city, without anybody really being clear on what you're looking for or what factors matter or why. So, you know, it's not surprising that doctrine, like what Justice Bork and Judge Scalia had to face, kind of led them in a functionalist route. But it's also not surprising that it's a little unsatisfying now because nobody quite knows what that test is and is trying to find something firmer to grapple with.
I think some of what you heard at argument does kind of raise, and I think New Jersey nodded to this, and I'm betting, Mr. Walters, that the other states are going to think this as well. You've got corporations and entities, and I'll use your term, arms of the state, that are set up in, you know, the 60s and 70s when you have this multi-factor balancing test kind of holding sway. What did New Jersey think it was doing in 1979? And if New Jersey anticipated the argument we heard on Wednesday, would they have done the same thing? So I'll start with Mr. Walters on that question. And Professor Bode, I think after that, I'm going to ask you, do we have to respect what a state thought it was doing in the legal regime it had at the time? So again, Mr. Walter, start with you, and then Professor Bode, we'll switch to that.
Yeah, I think this goes to the concern that Justice Kavanaugh raised about the blast radius of the of any decision here, you know, sort of reliance interests where states have structured parts of their government in reliance on older doctrines. What do we do with that? I think clearly if I think regardless of how this case comes out, I think a lot of states are going to have to evaluate for the future whether they can put a more formalist structure in place to avoid any sort of dispute in this area. So I would imagine you will see states, perhaps even including New Jersey, restructuring some of these separate corporate forms to put them within departments or have where they are actually part of other, you know, clear arms of the state government. So I think you're likely to see that regardless of what happens here, because it's unlikely that you're going to have a majority of the court that has a bright line rule, I would imagine. I think I would hope that we would get to some sort of some improvement over the multi-factor balancing test that we have. But I think there's a good chance that regardless of what the court does, states are going to have to start evaluating, not only going forward with how they're structuring government, but reevaluating how they have structured things over the last decades.
Yeah, I mean, I do think anybody who read Mount Healthy versus Doyle and thought that set forth a clear test that you could rely on, like, oh, we used to follow the traditional rule, but now we're safe creating separate persons and still calling them arms of the state, would have been pretty foolish, because the opinion itself is so muddy that I hope it wouldn't have led anybody to think, okay, all the old rules are out the window, and now we know we can, we can do this. And especially because Mount Healthy did find it reached the correct result that the school district, which was a separate corporation that could sue and be sued, could be held liable for kind of a muddied set of reasons. So I don't know what the, legislative history in 1979 would reveal. I'm not sure that's the best place to go looking. I do think the more the court could do just to make clear what it is that makes something a part of the state or not, the better. And again, I think separate personhood is the right question to ask, and we could talk about the indicia that are. But I think it would be good to give more of a sense of what it is. One thing that's interesting, I'm just thinking about this out loud, which is always dangerous, but one thing that's interesting about thinking about it from the point of view of reliance interests is that there are, in a sense, multiple sovereigns involved here. So one question is, of course, what did New Jersey think it was doing when it created a separate legal person with its own assets and liabilities from the Transit Corporation? And also, what did they think when they set up the subsidiary of the Transit Corporation, the Bus Corporation, the subsidiary of that bus, the Bus Corporation, the Insurance Corporation? But that's one question. But another question is, what did New York and Pennsylvania think they were doing when they allowed the New Jersey Transit Corporation to start sending buses into their states? And I don't know, but you could imagine that if they'd been told in advance, now this is a separate corporation that can sue and be sued in its own name and has its own assets, but actually it's under the cloak of New Jersey sovereign immunity. And so anything it does in your state can't be held to account in your state at all. I could imagine that the state of New York and the state of Pennsylvania would have been a little more nervous about that. They might have negotiated a compact where they said, actually, we're not very comfortable with that. We prefer people who drive large engines in our state to, post a bond at least or something where we know we can hold you accountable. I don't know. And you might actually see that if New Jersey wins the case. So I do think you've got to ask it in both directions. And that's part of what the interstate context is part of what makes this such, I think, a sharp case, right? In New Jersey's own courts, nobody really disputes that New Jersey can make it really hard to sue things, even if they're not sovereigns, because they control state tort law, make it really easy to sue things, even if they are sovereigns, because they can waive sovereign immunity. And the hard question is really, what does the Constitution allow New Jersey to demand of New York, and then vice versa? What does the Constitution allow New York to do to something that might or may not be part of New Jersey? So you can't kind of get away from the bedrock constitutional questions, I think.
I think that is an interesting point. And I think related to that was Nevada versus Hall, which came out, I think, just before New Jersey Transit was created. So a lot of states would have been thinking that, interstate sovereign immunity was not going to be a problem.
But obviously that was reversed by Hyatt III. So we are in a different world in a lot of different ways in this area.
Yeah. And this is also the Gorsuch question we were talking about earlier, which I do think is very interesting and is something not to sleep on, which is now that we're in this era where we're taking the Constitution itself a little more seriously on these terms, the 11th Amendment says the judicial power of the United States shall not be construed to extend to any suit in law or equity commenced or prosecuted against one of the United States by citizens of another state. And so Justice Gorsuch said, well, look, the Supreme Court, exercises the judicial power of the United States. New Jersey at least claims this is a state against the state of New Jersey by a citizen of another state. So if New Jersey is right, then shouldn't the Supreme Court have to dismiss the case for lack of appellate jurisdiction? The state courts below wouldn't be bound by that. They'd just be in Frederick's Taxpayer versus Hyatt, but wouldn't we then have to dismiss the case as improvidently granted? Interestingly, that question doesn't come up if the petitioners are right. So the petitioners are right that the New Jersey Transit Corporation's corporation, not the state, then the Supreme Court can hear the case. But if New Jersey's right, then suddenly there's an 11th Amendment problem lurking there. I think the state said, well, it wasn't commenced against, you look at how the suit was commenced, and when it was commenced, it was in state court, but the 11th Amendment also says prosecuted. I don't know, that would just be a hard question the court would suddenly have to dive into.
Also, I think I want to start with you, but it'll be a question for both of you. Judging from the way oral argument went, it doesn't sound like we're going to get a bright line rule out of the court this time around, which as a humble practitioner, I find unfortunate. So I guess from Texas and from the other states' perspective, if you're not going to get your bright line rule, what do you hope to get out of the Supreme Court? And what could you reasonably see in an opinion that at least allows states to make informed decisions about how they structure things like their cross-border transit corporations?
I think if they're going to stick with the Mount Healthy sort of test, the least that we would hope for would be to clarify some of these factors interact with each other. Are they, when you're balancing one thing against another that are not, correlated with each other, there's a lot of subjectivity in that. And if there were some clarity that if a particular prong were met, or if there's some sort of presumptions relating to either the intent of the state or the control of the state over it, or how much, if it's a functional versus a formalist liability test. If there were some movement on that, I would think that would be an improvement. And I think I think it's fair to hope for something like that. Based on the oral argument, but we don't know what direction they're going to go. And I do doubt that we're going to see something like either Professor Bode or the states that Texas filed a brief on behalf are going to be fully satisfied with.
I mean, I think, you should always hope the court does the right thing, but I guess one thing I would hope for, and maybe it's not too much to hope for, is for the court to maybe clarify that Mount Healthy was never supposed to be a test. It certainly was not supposed to be a test that just replaced everything we already knew about sovereign immunity and all these tests beforehand. So that it should be read, whatever we get out of it, it should be read maybe in light of the traditional test. And so if the traditional test gives us some clear answers, maybe Mount Healthy shouldn't be seen to replace it, but should instead be just seen as a gloss on the cases where the traditional test was harder. You see the court do this in other areas of law sometimes, where it says, okay, yes, the past 50 years we've started to say these things, but let's not lose sight of where things were before that, right? Let's not let the 50 most recent years of confusion completely eliminate the 180 years of law we had before that. So that might be one approach that might help them sort of move things towards a little more clarity. Again, they'd have to resolve the dispute about what is the more traditional test, which I hope they will and could. But maybe they could put that back on the table, and then over time that can give us a little bit more clarity rather than just, is it this factor rather than this factor, and how do you how do you tell if a car is more like a coffee urn or more like a spinning wheel or whatnot?
We got a question in our Q&A box, and at this point I will pause and reiterate for people. If you have questions, please use the Q&A function. Love to hear them, and we'll try to get through as many as we can. The first one is, if there's an 11th Amendment problem in this case, wouldn't it also have been an 11th Amendment problem in Hyatt 3? Guessing from your reaction, Professor Bode, you think, and they just ignored it.
Yes, there was an 11th Amendment problem in Hyatt 3. Full disclosure, it was pointed out to the court in an amicus brief by me and Professor Sachs to no avail. Either nobody read the brief or nobody cared or nobody agreed. I will say two things. One, after Hyatt 3, Justice Gorsuch noticed this problem more clearly in Penn East, a case about eminent domain and corporations, where he wrote a separate opinion noting this problem and relying on some analysis that Professor Sachs and I had done. So at least it now seems to be kind of a little bit more on their radar. Also, in their defense, there are two Supreme Court cases that say the 11th Amendment doesn't apply to the Supreme Court. Let's say, look, if the case was properly in the state court, then once it gets to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court's appellate jurisdiction is so important that it trumps the text of the 11th Amendment. One of these is a case called McKesson. The other one is a case called Bell South. These decisions are obviously wrong, and Justice Gorsuch knows as well as everybody that they're wrong, but it's true that they're there. So the fact that a precedent is obviously wrong doesn't always lead the court to ignore it, but obviously Justice Gorsuch is asking the question for a good reason.
Walter, anything to add?
I don't have anything to add. I think Professor Bode is the expert in that area.
The second question we got from our audience is for Professor Bode. Is there a Supreme Court case you think that most clearly establishes what you call the traditional test?
That's a great question. I think probably there are two that are the clearest ones. One would be there are a bunch of cases about this from the days of the state-owned bank, but probably Bank of the United States versus Planters Bank of Georgia, where the court is dealing with a suit against the Planters Bank of Georgia and has to explain why that's not the same as a suit against the state of Georgia, and says a lot of the elements of the traditional test, that because it's a separate corporation and the idea of creating a separate corporation is to create a separate person, even if the state of Georgia controls the corporation and is the corporator and is the kind of the power behind the throne and so on. But the other case that's a little more recent, but that I do think is very helpful for thinking of the traditional test as well, is Hopkins versus Clemson Agricultural College of South Carolina, where the court's dealing with a state college, and again talks about public corporations not having sovereign immunity, and tries to distinguish between how you know when it's a suit against the public corporation versus a suit against the state. That I think I wouldn't say it establishes the traditional test, but it's a nice indicator of the life of the traditional test, even into the 20th century. The last thing I'd say, which we haven't talked about that much, but is worth noting, is I think everybody still agrees. It's been black letter law for 150 years that cities do not have sovereign immunity, even though, of course, cities are state actors for lots of purposes. States fund their cities. If a major city needs money, the state ends up bailing it out, even if they don't have to. But it's incredibly well established that cities are not arms of the state. And so it's worth thinking about sort of why that is, right? And I think the most straightforward reason, which comes from some of the old cases, is that cities were understood as corporations, as municipal corporations, and that's where this sort of corporateness of the test comes from. But on any test, even if you replace the traditional test with something else, everybody seems to agree cities aren't immune. And so it's worth thinking about why that is and what that tells us about, not everything that the state does, even if it's important, even if the state legislature might have ultimate sovereignty, not everything a state does is the state as sovereign.
I want to hit you with, I guess, what was for me maybe the most difficult question for either side. And Mr. Walters, I'll start with you. So I think it was Justice Jackson who raised the question of whether the corporate form has consequences. We generally agree that if some combination of real live human persons set up a corporation, it's a separate legal entity, it holds its own assets, holds its own liabilities, and that its separation from the underlying real human beings is sort of the point of the corporate form. What's maybe the best argument for why that shouldn't also be true as to corporations set up by the state? Because it sure sounds like the New Jersey Transit Corporation is set up separately from New Jersey for the point of creating separation.
Right. I think the answer is that states create their law, including what sort of entities are able to create and what effect those entities have. So I think it is, while it's fair to say there was a history of what corporate law, creation of corporations, what effect that had, that doesn't mean that states with their sort of residual sovereign power cannot create new forms with new effects. I think that's the issue. Obviously, in the interstate context, you have this sort of conflict, you know, among more than one state. The argument that New Jersey made was that some of the early discussion about mere corporations, which was a term that was used a lot, that was to actually define something different than sort of corporations writ large. So subordinate sort of mere corporations, which is what we are largely talking about, versus, you know, a lot of the states were formed as they had corporate charters. There is the argument of New Jersey is that it can create a sort of public corporation that is part of the state that it can define what effect that has, and that another state should not be able to, in its own courts, contradict that.
That actually leads to the question I was going to ask Professor Bode, which is, you know, if you read Hyatt 3, we're talking about interstate sovereign immunity, which Hyatt seems to paint, correct me if I'm wrong, seems to paint it as a matter of fundamental comedy. You have to extend to a sister state the same immunity that you retain for yourself. With that as the premise, why shouldn't a state's declaration of what its own arms are be kind of the controlling factor here?
Yeah, so I guess an important thing to think about, an important thing to distinguish between are two kinds of immunities that you can collapse outside the Hyatt context, you can collapse, which are like personal immunity, immunity from suit, sovereign immunity, and what we might call merits immunity, just the fact that like the state writes the law, right? New Jersey writes New Jersey tort law, and they can make New Jersey tort law do all sorts of different things. And in New Jersey, both those things go together, and we don't have to think about them separately. But in the Hyatt context, you really have to think carefully about the difference between those two powers, because I think nobody disputes that New York is in charge of tort law in New York. Like in general, when people get hit by buses in New York, that's something that New York gets to deal with, right? And New York gets to decide what the consequences of that are and whether the buses are worth the risk and so on. And I think nobody would dispute like the Hyatt comedy principle and say, of course, that has to be true. And of course, New Jersey can't go into New York and start authorizing people to get hit by buses on the merits. So the question is just, now at the same time, the method of, according to Hyatt, the method of having states respect one another's sovereignty is not to haul one another as sovereigns into one another's courts. And so we need some test, probably not one that's just left at the discretion of New Jersey or the discretion of New York, I guess, about like what part of, you know, what exactly is it that is New Jersey that's in New York and immune from suit? And if you do that too capaciously, or if you let New Jersey just write the rules for what parts of New Jersey can go into New York and do things without consequences, without being able to be hauled into court, I think you'd worry about that same comedy problem, right? That New Jersey can go into other states, cloak itself in immunity, and then ignore the law when it does so. So that's at least that sort of goes to the thing the court's trying to deal with, they're trying to balance under the Hyatt framework.
As we near our time, I'm going to ask both of you and I'll make the sort of last call for questions and Q&A. But what are your predictions on vote count and the rule that we get out of this case? Not everyone at once.
Well, you know, it's always perilous to judge how someone's going to vote based on their questions at argument. But I would say that Justices Jackson and Sotomayor are the strongest votes against New Jersey Transit here, based on what I heard. I think that the justices is most likely to rule in favor of New Jersey Transit would probably be Kavanaugh, Roberts, maybe Alito. And then Justice Kagan, she's kind of a wild card based on what she said at argument. She might be ruling in favor of New Jersey Transit too, although maybe she's just playing devil's advocate with her points about Biden versus Nebraska. And Justice Thomas, and Justice Gorsuch, I think are hard to predict in this area because they could go for some sort of, if they do find that it is an arm of the state, there might be some jurisdictional issues with the 11th Amendment that Professor Bode has raised. So I don't know that we're going to get a majority opinion in this area, but I can't give a definite vote count based on what I heard at argument.
I think we read the argument the same way. I think it's right that Justice Kavanaugh definitely asked the hardest questions for the petitioners and is thinking a lot about, you know, probably his own lower court opinion that Ryan mentioned in Puerto Rico Ports case and what Bork and Scalia did with the Metro and so on. And then Gorsuch and Jackson and company might be a little bit differently. I mean, I guess. If I had to predict, I predict it's probably going to be a unanimous win for the plaintiffs. I think the court will probably say a lot of things are confusing and we're not resolving it all. But, you know, but this is a case where it looks like a duck and walks like a duck and quacks like a duck. And so it's not New Jersey. But, you know, predictions are hard, especially about the future.
For my last call, we did get one more question, which was that Justice Gorsuch noted that in the federal agency context, sort of the be sued clause is not the end of the story. Did you think that Mr. Kimberly's answer to that question was satisfactory?
Yeah, I do think one thing he said that I do think is right is that in the federal agency context, you have both the kind of merits immunity issues and the personal immunity issues together, right? Congress controls whether to waive sovereign immunity, whether to create a cause of action, whether to give jurisdiction to the U.S. courts. And for many things that don't involve the Constitution, the substantive law. And so even if the court has not always been careful about which one of those things is at stake, it's not surprising that in a question of whether you can sue a federal thing in federal court, the sue and be sued thing is not the end of the story because you got all those other doctrines. I think that part's right, even if it's maybe not always been, but clearly disentangled.
Final thoughts, gentlemen? Well, then, first of all, thank you both for being willing to share an hour and share your expertise with all of us. Many thanks to all of you participants and audience members, both for your questions and for being here and for caring about these questions. And, of course, to the Federalist Society for hosting what proved to be a rousing conversation and debate. So with that, I bid you all a very good lunch hour. And I think Sarah may be coming back to close us out.
Yes, thank you so much. I just wanted to thank Professor Bode and Mr. Walters for speaking with us today and for Mr. Williamson for moderating. We're so grateful for your time and expertise on this important topic. Thank you to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can also stay up to date with other announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.